Well, hello, everybody. It's Bob McCallum. It's John Shannon. Again, you're chortling right at the beginning.
Well, I always get a kick out of how you know, when you were doing radio, it was easy to do because the music started, and then it was...
Why don't we have music at the beginning of this?
Well, because
but we don't hear it.
Yeah, that's right. We're doing it. I watch your mind at work to say, how the heck am I going to start this show today? And so it always makes me laugh. Sorry.
Well, when in doubt, I go to my my Bob Uecker opening.
Hi, everybody.
Exactly. McCallum and Shannon here on this ridiculous program. What is this? Day three of the new year.
Day three of the new year. Come on now. You know, we've been doing this now. Gosh, it's how many months now, Bob? 14 or 15 months?
Oh, this show.
Yes. Yeah.
Who knows? When we get to 40 or 50 years, it'll be worth talking about. And we're not getting to 40 or 50 years.
That ain't going to happen, man.
Doug Armstrong is going to join us, the managing general of the St. Louis Blues, who we like to talk to. But also, not only the GM of the Blues, was the general manager of Team Canada for the Beijing Olympics. And obviously, Team Canada ain't going, or at least the NHL players aren't going. So Armstrong resigned that position, which at the time sounded like something a little like weird. Why would you resign? But there is a Team Canada going to go.
Yeah, Shane Jones is going to be the general manager. Yeah. And now that the Olympic break's on, Doug's team's going to play during the Olympic break, right?
Well, yeah, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
In any event, that's who's coming up. Doug Armstrong, when we come back after these messages. He is the general manager of the St. Louis Blues and would have been, I guess, the general manager of Team Canada for the Olympics. That, of course, has been canceled. Doug Armstrong is with us. You know, so on that note, Doug, how disappointed are you still at that missed opportunity?
Obviously, you're disappointed. I think that as a fan, I'm probably more disappointed than I am as working for Hockey Canada, in the sense that the chance to see best on best, you know, the thought of Crosby with McDavid and McKinnon and players like that, the thought of Matthews and Kane together, you know, there was so many great storylines going into this. And I'm a big believer on best hockey. And I would have loved to have been viewing that, whether it was part of Hockey Canada or not, then also obviously being part of the selection process and getting to work with the coaches and the management staff was a huge thrill. And I'm sorry we can't see that through.
You talk about the selection process. You guys met, I guess, in person once in Florida in the last month or so. How much of an enjoyment was that to literally be, I want to say, the Monopoly board style, be able to pick your players on your roster?
It was a lot of fun. Obviously, you go through it, and we don't scout the players that we were selecting for this tournament. And I've been through that in 10 and 14 working for Steve Yzerman. Like when you go to a game, you don't watch Connor McDavid, or you don't watch McKinnon, or you don't watch Crosby for your day job. They're not available. So it was a really rewarding process to try and see these players and how you can put players with them that can give them the greatest chance of success. And it was a lot of fun watching the best that Canada has to offer and try and make that puzzle come out where it's not just an all-star team, but a team that can compete against the other top teams in the world.
The commissioner has come out and suggested that maybe hockey should be played in the Summer Olympics instead of the Winter Olympics. And there is some reason to at least raise a Spocky and eyebrow and say, well, that's actually not a bad idea. It does solve a few of the problems. How do you feel about that possibility?
Well, I certainly understand, you know, it would solve the NHL's problems. Maybe I'm a little bit old school, but I think hockey's a winter sport. You know, you could just hockey and diving doesn't seem to go together to me. But, you know, if
I don't know. I don't know. there's a lot of players that think hockey and diving go together a lot.
Good point. We'd have to have Coley and his group working overtime on those fines they send out. No, but I understand it from a logistical standpoint to try and get it together. Again, the Summer Olympics does move, doesn't it, from July to August?
Yeah.
I think from depending on the country, there'd be a lot of hurdles to go through with the players to make sure that, you know, they wanted to do that. But I certainly understand it to guarantee best on best. But in 10 and 14, we were able to work it out. And certainly prior to that also, where it was a winter sport. And to me, hockey's a winter sport. But to see best on best, you'd certainly make whatever concessions that were needed.
Well, even more pragmatic, would you if you had to choose between one or the other, would you take a World Cup over an Olympics?
No. I just, again, I shouldn't have answered that so quickly. The Olympics, to me, are it's the premier event in sport. That's every 4 years. We all grew up on it, no matter how old anyone is. We all grew up on the Olympics, and it's changed over time, gone from amateur to professionals. And but to me, it's still the premier event in the world.
Well, what about the alternative of, I mean, and we got into, John and I got into a long discussion on this, I think just yesterday, on the NHL's commitment to a World Cup. And I've tried to make the point that it doesn't seem they have any commitment to it. It's kind of a willy-nilly whenever we can, and whether it's CBA issues or whatever gets in the way, there really isn't a commitment to do a World Cup on a regular basis. But now you miss the Olympic Games. Would you be in favor of a World Cup in the next 18 months, let's say, just hypothetically?
Well, again, I was part of the World Cup in 16, and I really enjoyed that. And it was going to be almost a major event every couple of years. And then the pandemic and the CBA, there's lots of reasons why it didn't happen. But again, I love best on best. It's just a different flair to it. And I guess one of the things I should probably elaborate on, it's not I'm anti-World Cup. It's just when you're part of the Olympics, you're part of Team Canada as a whole, not just a hockey community.
Sure.
And you're such a small piece of such a bigger puzzle. And part of the joy and the memories that I think anyone has going to the Olympics is the interaction with other athletes, getting to see what makes them tick. And, you know, I'm not after the fact that working in the NHL, you know, your pay grade's a little bit different than a curler. And, you know, to see the commitment that they're making onto it, or the skiers or everyone else like that, it just makes you feel different about your sport. But back to the World Cup, I love best on best. I think that 16 was very good. We had the Young Guns team that came on and burst onto the scene. I'm not sure that you could count on having that caliber of Young Guns team every year. When you look back at the players that were on that team, there's going to be a lot of future Hall of Famers on there. And if you go a couple of bad draft classes, or not bad, but less than Connor McDavid, Austin Matthews draft classes, that team might not have the same effect. So I love best on best, country on country, but I also tip my hat to the NHL for coming up with a unique way to give that a shot in the arm with that Young Guns team.
Yeah, in fairness, Connor McDavid would rather play for Canada, I'm sure, and Austin would rather play for Team USA, I'm sure, than play for a hybrid team, don't you think?
I would think so. Probably we would have maybe taken out that team two or three players that would have pushed very hard for our team. Again, you look at Eric Lindros back in, what would that have been, the 80s playing in the Canada Cup? Or 90s, maybe it, you know, at 18 years old, like there's the odd player that can play past his age group like that. But I know that, you know, whether it was McKinnon or whether it was Matthews or whether it was McDavid, I think their druthers would be to play for their national team against the other country's best players.
Were you involved at all in the ultimate decision to not go to Beijing?
Well above my pay grade. Well above my pay grade. I think that was something that the league and the union worked hard on. I know that the players really wanted to go, and I really truly believe that the league understood that and did everything they could do to make that happen. But you know, we are part of the NHL and our business plan, and it's been disrupted for a couple of years now, and we have to get back on solid footing. We have to generate revenue so the pie can grow for the players. And I certainly understood the decision, but no, it was made well above my pay grade.
Well, all been to the Olympic Games. We all understand, and you were alluding to this before, the atmosphere, the feeling of, you know, you're there with, well, you get a chance to meet all kinds of athletes that you've heard of and but have never had a chance to meet and interact with them and socialize with them. But that's under in a normal scenario, Doug, you would understand. And Beijing was never going to be that. Beijing was basically going to be isolation for each of the teams and no opportunity to go and see other sports, no real opportunity in all likelihood to intermingle and get to know some of the other athletes. Does that lessen in any way the disappointment of going?
Well, I'm not sure that was actually going to be the case when it finally came down. It sounded like they were opening up maybe the food hall. They were going to open up the venues to the athletes to go watch other events. Again, it was all going to be based on where COVID was at that day when you got off the plane.
Sure.
But yeah, it certainly would have been different. You know, I've been participated in 10 when I wasn't in the village. We had access to the village. And then in 14 in Sochi, we were embedded with the team in the village. And it was a great atmosphere. As you talk about, you're going to the mess hall and it's open 24 hours and you're seeing guys from that you see on television. And you get the chance to talk to them and meet with them. And even in our own fraternity, the women's and men's hockey teams got to intermingle, and it would have been different. I don't think it would have been less. It just would have been different.
How close did you get to a final roster?
I'd say probably 70%. What we worked on, John, was we started this 18 months ago, let's say, and we all put together, okay, locks on the team. And those guys, maybe one or two from day one sifted out, that might have been less than half the team. You know, and not talking out of school. You got McDavid, you got Crosby, you know, you got players that you know are going to be on there. But, you know, after that, we started to build that up. I think we were probably 10 forwards guaranteed, like in our mind, coming out of our meeting in early December and four defensemen. The goaltending was obviously the most fluid just because of Carey coming back and the other guys on the list showing great promise at different times. And that was going to be an interesting discussion.
Well, as you've kind of alluded to here, I think most people would concede, and I think you've conceded, that there are some no-brainers. I mean, there are some obvious choices. And it would be shocking if you guys hadn't selected them. But when you get down to the 9th, 10th, 11th forward, the 6th, 7th defenseman, 2nd, 3rd goaltender even, are those decisions for a Team Canada, do you think, more important than those kinds of decisions you would make for the St. Louis Blues?
I think so. And what we tried to do, Bob, there was work like, okay, synergy. What's the best case scenario? You know, you've heard a lot of different names come out, like in 14, Chris Kunitz, he made the team, not because of Sidney Crosby, but his relationship with Sidney and how they played together certainly helped that process. In 10, you had Keith and Seabrook that played together in Chicago, you know, so you start looking at those different things. How can they help? And then you also have to make sure that the players that you're selecting for Hockey Canada, for Team Canada, are big minute players. And you have to make sure that everyone understands that some guys have to give a lot to make this team, meaning you're going to go from 17 to 21 minutes as a forward, from 20 to 26 as a defenseman, maybe down to 8 or 9 minutes. We went back and we looked at the ice time over the medal rounds, and we have some forwards playing eight to nine minutes. And that they're not used to that. So you have to have high character people, and you want to make sure that everyone going in, if they're in that area of discussion, they want to buy into that. And that's doing the research with their coaches, with their teammates, and knowing that. And a perfect example for that was PK Subban in Sochi, probably our biggest supporter over there. His ice time wasn't what it was in the NHL, but he bought in and he had a smile on his face and he made sure everybody knew that he was part of that program and he was just a joy to be with.
Hey, the other thing in my recollection of 2010 in Vancouver was, if you had 12 forwards, you had about 10 centers. you because, and I assume that was because of their, you needed the versatility. Would you have had the same approach in 22?
Yeah, and it's pretty well, if you look back in Hockey Canada history, the centermen are it's always easier to move a centerman to the wing than a winger to the middle of the ice. But the most dominant players usually on every team are down the middle of the ice, whether it's a centerman, defenseman, or goalie. That's how you build your teams. And the ability for Bergeron to slide over and Crosby to play together. Obviously, when you look at Point and McKinnon and Crosby, the depth at center ice, guys were going to have to slide over to the wing, and that would have been no different this year. I also think it allows the coach a lot more flexibility because you can have right and left shot guys on taking faceoffs. So it does open up a lot of different things. But yeah, center ice would have been, there would have been four listed on the sheet, but there would have been probably eight or nine playing every game.
Yeah. How much interaction with John Cooper did you have? I mean, you had your management team, but, and I remember asking you one day, I think Tampa was playing in St. Louis, and I said, did you have some time with Coop? And you said, I talked to him on the phone, but did you have much time with him at all?
I did. We did a lot of communicating on the phone, and it picked up, John. Like we got together, had our first really, he and I went to Calgary early for our meeting, spent a couple of days, get to know each other. You know everybody in the NHL, but you really don't know anybody in the NHL. So we got out there to Banff. We spent a couple of days together, and then the rest of the staff came in. And we kept them abreast of what our thought process was. And then when you get to that 10 or 11 forwards done, those, then you say, okay, how do you see this? What do you think you need when you see this group? If we have our main power play and penalty kill guys, are they in this group? How do we have to add to what you need to have success? And so he and I would talk much more, much frequent, at a higher frequency, as we got closer to at least once a week, and probably even a little bit more of that from mid-November to mid-December.
You talked about strength down the middle. Biggest challenge would have been goaltending?
It would have been the most talked about, I would say. Okay. You know, just you have Carey Price and, I had a brief conversation with him, to tell him that we supported whatever his decision was going to be. But I asked him, like, if you're playing, do you want to come? And I didn't know what was going on around him. And he said, no, if I've earned the right, I'd love to come. And so you pencil that in. And then, but the other guys that were on our long list all played some great games and all had some games where they might have given a goal and they want back. And that's normal. I think Hockey Canada has been spoiled for a long time in net, and sort of going into it, you saw how last year's playoffs ended with Carey Price, and you sort of put, okay, well, you could have named him as one of your three guys at the start, and no one would have raised their eyebrow whatsoever. So his situation made it maybe a more open competition than it had been in the past.
I want to go back to the previous answer. And your conversations with Cooper, it seems clear that there was a, direct communication, a consultation between the two of you as to what he wanted, what you could do, you know, the decisions that were going to be made. I'm intrigued, Doug, whether is this dramatically different from what would happen with your coach with the St. Louis Blues or with any other general manager and coach at the NHL level? Is it because it was Team Canada? Did it make it more of a joint decision, perhaps?
Probably 50-50 on that one. And I'm not trying to be evasive, but I think that, you know, you want to tell John, and I want to tell Craig Green when I work with him, there's no sense me jamming a square peg into a round hole.
Sure.
So if we view as a management group, this guy playing with this guy and being a penalty killer, and he has no time for him. He says, I like this guy better on the right faceoff dot. I'm not going to use him there. There's no sense taking the player. And there's all, and it's more, I would say at the NHL level, making trades. You know, I bring Craig in probably the last 15 or 10% just to see if there's any red flags with him on what we're trying to do. We talk on a daily basis at the NHL level. So I know where his love is for certain players and his lack of love is for other players and what you can do to improve that team. So I would say with John though, like when you get into those probably last couple of forwards and the last D, you want to make sure that my vision would be, okay, we want to bring a skilled right-handed defenseman. And he said, well, if we have this one, I'm more comfortable using another player in that position. Mm-hmm. If that guy gets hurt, instead of the guy I'm thinking of. And so again, I don't want to give specific names, but it's one of those ones where you want to make sure that he has the tools in his toolbox that he thinks he can win with.
This is also a team that doesn't have a salary cap, so you don't have that problem to worry about.
Yeah, it's amazing when you started to, I would mess around that at home and I'd put this roster together. Then I'd say what that cost. And it reminded me back of my days in Dallas.
You want to share the number with us?
I think it was a lot. It would be four caps in the NHL.
I was going to say it had to be at least $250 million.
Oh yeah.
I
mean, come on. Yeah. 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 And then especially if you added in how some of the contracts are structured, not just cap, but how the cash is paid out in certain years, it can get up there pretty quick.
Oh man, that's funny.
Well, your team, your regular team, recently played in an outdoor game. We want to address that and the rest of the season and some of the other things that have been going on. Doug Armstrong is with us, the GM of the St. Louis Blues. We'll come back with more after these messages. Bob McCowan, John Shannon with you on the program today, and Doug Armstrong is with us. Well, let me start it off by this. You a fan of outdoor games?
I am. We've played in two of them. I wasn't really sure when it started out. The experience we had in Minneapolis was fantastic. It was cold. Obviously, everyone knows that the temperature there, but just even playing it under the lights, I thought it had a better feel to it at night. The city was beautiful. It was lit up. Now there was no snow. It was a clear night. It was, we'll call it crisp. I think it was a great event. And also, Bob, you know it's a good event when the players are that excited to participate in it. And I think the NHL is onto something. And having the Winter Classic and then the other outdoor events have their own title, but the Winter Classic on January 1st, I think is something that I've been forced to be part of. And I think it's something that I hope the league continues with, and because it is a marquee event, a ton of fun.
Is it more fun to be a visitor or the home team? Because when you're the home team, there's a lot more distractions.
Yeah, we talked about that. Any event that you go to is a lot of fun, but it's always more enjoyable when you win. And I found it probably a little bit easier to have a normal routine going in on the road. Went in on the 30th at night. Got in about 7 or 8 o'clock at night, went right to our hotel. But what we did is we went over to the arena or to the stadium on the 31st in the morning. We didn't go on the ice. But we were able to see the locker room. So we went in that evening for the skate. It wasn't all new. And then it just sort of became a regular game day the next day, just with family around. And I think it's easier to be a road team, but you miss out on a lot of the events being a road team that you can take advantage of at home too. So there's no downside to being either, but I think from a competitive standpoint, I think being the road team is probably allows you to keep your focus.
Any cautionary tales that are passed along to the players before a game like this? I mean, I think we're all old enough to remember the first time it happened in Edmonton, and the talk was, well, you know, the ice might not be great and there might be ruts and this might happen and be careful with this and blah, 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 blah. Do you still go through any of that?
Yeah, I think what Craig talks about obviously is simplifying your game. You know, the ice is going to be different. The atmosphere is going to be different. But at the end of the day, it is hockey. I think that you pick up things along the way, quite honestly, on how to layer up, how to stay warm, what's overkill, what's too much. There was no overkill on warmth in this event, though. The guys needed every layer that they had on there. But there are things that you do pick up. I remember I was going to take my son. He was very young at the time, maybe 7 or 8, out to Edmonton. He got sick, so we didn't get on the flight. Then I watched that game, the Edmonton-Montreal, and I was like, oh, thank God he got sick. It looked so cold that night. And I'm not sure they were ready for it. Quite honestly, the NHL does a great job of giving us enough swag to stay warm with too. So, and the benches now are heated for the players a little bit. So they do a great job, but it is a different event. I think, when we had it in St. Louis, it rained. It was like a 38 to 40 degrees. So you had that rain, and that messes with the ice. But if you're mentally tough and you understand that if you're going to get rattled over things happening, you're probably not going to have success. You have to just be able to roll with the punches.
Now you're a few years younger than me, but did you grow up playing outdoors?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Sarnia. Yeah. We played a lot of time outdoors again. My father built a rink in the yard every day. The other fathers would come over and put up the boards. And then when spring came along, we'd go back and pick up about 100 lost pucks that we couldn't find in the snow. And we didn't play a lot of games outside in Sarnia, but we skated a lot outside.
Well, my recollection was wind was the biggest enemy. And the big, like if you were trying to go into the wind, if you're playing a game outdoors and you're trying to go into the wind, wow, what a pain that was.
That's just like street hockey when you couldn't control that tennis ball.
No
That's
kidding, right. huh?
But, and by the way, there was no problem with the Armstrong family having hockey pucks, because I'm sure your dad put a few in his pocket as the day went on, right?
Yeah, we had a big closet full of hockey pucks.
Hey, I read a story that Jordan Binnington actually had chicken soup in his water bottle. Is that true?
I think the guys put it in there, chicken broth. Yeah, yeah. Our team has... They've got a personality of having a lot of personality. Yeah. We saw them get off the bus with the beach gear on, a lot of practical jokers. So I think they grabbed Binner's water bottle and then just threw chicken broth in there, and he squirted it the first time. Thank God it wasn't steaming hot, but they seem to have a lot of fun, and I think that allows us to be that's how our team is this year. Every team's always different, but this one's a lot of fun.
And your training staff, your equipment guys, had a relationship with the Packers. And you got some tips about from the Packers on how to stay warm on a cold weather environment.
Yeah. Yeah. Richie Matthews, he came in and we had the bag from the NHL, and he added a few different layers of basically different thermal long underwear that was actually really effective. It really worked well. And again, everybody is so professional in the NHL right now. They'll reach out to anybody about playing outside, how to just get little tips on what they needed to do. And again, it just had to double stuff the swag bag getting home, because we had more stuff.
So where did you watch the game from? Where did you go?
Yeah, I'd like to know this one. He wasn't sitting in the corner.
Come on, where were you?
I watched the first period from the press box, but it was a little bit far away. And so I went downstairs, and I got to say, I went outside and I watched the concert live. And then I went back and I lied on the training table and watched the second and third period.
It's rough, those outdoor games, huh?
It's funny because you were talking about John Cooper. So John sends me a text. He says, it looks freaking cold there. And I sent him a picture back of me lying on the table. It's actually not that bad.
So your team's playing pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah, we are. We got off to a great start, and then I think 5-0, and then we stubbed our toe for a little bit and got back close to like 2 or 3 games over 500. And then all of a sudden COVID hit us and injuries hit us, and our guys from the American League came up and just played great hockey. And really the energy came back to our group, and they've taken off right now. We got a great game against Pittsburgh here tonight. But we're in a place where we feel really comfortable that we compete with the better teams in the league. Obviously my belief is Colorado is still the best team, if not in the NHL, in the Western Conference. They're the one that has the the bullseye on their back. And I saw Makar's goal last night against Chicago. Like, that's a guy that I was excited to watch at the Olympics also. I'm happy for our guys. They're playing really good hockey. We're healthy. Tonight, we're have all of our forwards available for selection for the second time this year. So we're going to see what we're made of here in the next little while. We got great games coming up with Pittsburgh and Washington. But overall, Craig Berube's done a great job of making sure that we're in a spot now where we can compete.
All so your players, but not your coaches.
Yeah, our coaches are taking it on the chin now. I felt bad for Mike Van Ryan. He got COVID. We landed in Minnesota, and then he got COVID when we got there. So he had to drive back home and miss that game. And then Steve Ott was out playing with his son after practice the other day and went down to pick up his stick, and his back went out. So he got a couple of cortisone shots. He's with us on the trip. We brought up Drew Bannister. The first time in my career, we've had to call a coach from the minors to help us out. But he's here in Pittsburgh tonight. And our coach are tough guys. They'll be back quick, though.
You know, it seems to me that, you know, we've all experienced this COVID stuff. When we started out, none of us knew anything about it, knew what to do or how to react. The least of which you as a general manager in the National Hockey League. But the fact of the matter is that those early days of COVID, from a hockey perspective, things were pretty much under control. There weren't a lot of outbreaks. There weren't a lot of guys getting sick. No, there wasn't anybody in the arenas. Yes, games were being played in a limited number of venues. No, there wasn't any travel. But what have you learned in dealing with COVID, and especially the last few months, where every team like yours has gone through bouts where a bunch of players get sick?
Yeah, I think that initially we were all afraid. I speak for myself, but everybody was afraid because nobody knew what this disease was, how it was going to affect us. And then when we got into Edmonton, we felt very comfortable. Everyone had tested negative. They had secured that down with barbed wire. And I mean, you were locked in there, and we felt really good. And then you realized through the news outlets that if you took the proper precautions, you were going to be okay. And the league mandated that everyone get the proper precautions, the vaccines. And so I'm probably now well to the right of, I think there's a huge overreaction to COVID. Now, I'm not in Canada, so I don't know the hospital beds and the things that you guys are dealing with, but we live in the States, and it's amazing what a border can do. I was watching the game the other night, and they had called the World Junior, and I watch out, and we play in front of 18,600 sellout, and I'm watching Tampa play in front of 19,300 sellout in their building. I would say where I'm at with COVID now, if you've had the ability to get your shots and get your boosters and you haven't done that, then that's on you, and the rest of the world should get back up and running.
Interesting.
Your Olympic break is gone now. You're going to end up playing games. How many postponed games do you have on your schedule?
We just have three. And I think what they're going to have to do, though, John, is that probably change the rest of our schedule to accommodate those three games in the sense of travel and things like that. Steve Hatcher-Petros, who does that for the league, is a friend. I've worked with him for 20 years, and I talked to him today, actually, and I felt bad for him because he's fielding calls, and I said, we're low priority. We only have three games. It was just more of a call to find out what part of the break, and what I think they're going to do is just try and balance out the schedule, and we're accepting of whatever they come up with. Everyone's going to get the all-star breakout and whatever they do around that, but we understand that we're not going to the Olympics for a reason. We need to generate revenue. We need to play all 82 games, and however they come up with that, we'll be ready for it.
Do you have any concern that the season will be extended a bit, do you think?
I don't think so. Again, a little bit above my pay grade, but I think you take that Olympic time. I think hopefully they'll be able to push some games into there and even rework some games and maybe even to the end of January to get it done. I know that the commissioner and everyone wants to get back on the draft at a certain time, make sure next season starts at the same time. So you can never say no with COVID if there's another variant, something comes up and things gets pushed. But I'm hoping, and I think everyone's hoping now, that we end on the date we're supposed to end on and the playoffs end when they're supposed to, the draft ends, and we get back into a normal summer.
Well, what isn't above your pay grade, in fact, it is your pay grade, is making trades. And we are at that time of year now where at least conversations are beginning. We know that most of the deals are done in and around the deadline. How has COVID affect not just the execution of trades, but the thought process with trades?
Well, last year it had a huge effect just because of border crossing. Yep. This is our first year of more normal trade talk. And again, border crossings now are starting to pick back up, be at least a focal point for me on if you trade for a player, and probably more for a player going into Canada than a player coming into the States. It's a little more difficult to get into Canada. So I think that has to play a factor for the Canadian teams and what they're going to do. But as far as it doesn't come up in our conversations when we're having managers, but as you said, we're at probably, if it's a 100-yard dash, we're just out of the blocks on the trades now.
Sure.
And I think certainly in the Western Conference, it seems a little more clustered on potential playoff teams. The Eastern Conference, that variance seems to be getting bigger and bigger. So teams aren't quite ready yet to put the stake in that we're a buyer, and teams aren't quite ready yet to put the stake in that we're a seller. But conversations are starting, and this is probably going into what we thought was going to be Olympics. A lot of the pro scouting meetings are going to be happening at the end of January. I know we've pushed ours back till the end of February now, because you want to have the most up-to-date information as you're going into the last couple of weeks. And I think it's just human nature. Guys get signed when they're just the day before they become free agents, and trades happen when they have to happen. There's not everyone says they want to get it done early, and no one seemed to can get it done early.
Well, no.
And so,
I didn't mean to interrupt you, I was wondering if you have ever been or would ever be reactionary in terms of making a trade. And let me explain here. So if a team that you're competitive with, a team that you feel is potentially going to stand in your way of winning a Stanley Cup,
like Colorado,
makes a move, would you be inclined to view your team and what you're going to do differently rather than if they did not make a move? In other words, would you make a reactionary trade?
I don't believe in that. And I just go back to my days in Dallas with Bob Gainey, and Detroit and Dallas were always sort of seemed to be battling there. And we played each other once in the playoffs. You know, they lost, we lost, something happened along the way.
Yeah.
And so you think like that, but you don't react to that. And then I've just always felt that if you take care of your own business, let the other teams, and then we'll see who's the best at the end. But if you think you're a cup contending team, I don't think that if Colorado did something, I could go out and counter that in any way, shape, or form. Colorado, I'm sure, is scouting the top teams, and hopefully we're one of them, and says, okay, this is how we're going to play them. But I don't think they're concerned about what we do, and we watch what they do, but I don't think we react to it. Mm-hmm. We have to take care of our own business.
I tell you what, you are in a division that I don't think anybody could have predicted the way it would be now. Respectfully, David Poyle's a friend of both of ours. I didn't think Nashville would be this good, and they are really good. Minnesota is, you know, it's on the rise. You are in the toughest division in the league, don't you think?
I think so. And I give David a lot of credit. In today's world of social media and everything, you're probably not nearly as good as people say you are. And you're not nearly as bad as people think you are. And I look at David, he's such a, he's one of the top managers in the game's ever seen. He's got 1,000 wins. He's got leads the league in so many different management categories. So I'm not surprised they are where they are. But I do like our division. I think it's competitive. A team that not a lot of people talk about is Winnipeg. They're scary good. You know, they're very scary good. Like, you know, you never want to pick who you want to play in the playoffs, but there's a lot of teams you don't want to play, and a lot are in the Central Division.
So the other thing is that last summer, Vladdy Tarasenko said he didn't want to be a Blue anymore. Now he's come out and had, and I think I know you well enough to know the conversation would be, I'll tell you what, Vladdy, if you want to be traded, show us how good you can be. Show everybody in the league how good you can play. Well, he's showed everybody how good he can play. He's a hell of a player, and he's played great for your team. What do you do now? Do you think he still wants to be traded?
Well, to answer your question, we did have that conversation that I'm not in the business of selling, 10 cents on the dollar. That's bad for my business. So you got to get back, and you got to play, and you got to play very well. And I give him a ton of credit. He's played great hockey. He seems to be having a lot of fun, a lot of enjoyment. What we talked about the start of the season was, let's get off and see how we're doing. It's not something that I'm going to bring up to him. He's here. He's got this year and next year. I think we've tried to show to him that whatever mistakes that I had made in the past or the organization had made, we accept them and we want to move on with him. And to his credit, he's playing fantastic hockey. And, there's been no conversations, and I don't plan on having any. And I hope he keeps going. And again, I give him a ton of credit. He showed a lot of character, because when that information comes out, people are forced to take a side. Some right. people are pro St. Louis Blues, and some people are pro Vladdy. And he's been able now to put us all back in together. And I give him a ton of credit for how he handled that. Was one of the first guys at training camp in September, walked through the door with his head held high, said, I made statements. I believe him, and they weren't about his teammates. They weren't about anything like that. And he's done a great job for us.
Anything else, John, from you?
The only other thing is, I remember back to, that 2019 season, the year you won the Stanley Cup, and you were brutal the first half of the season. And then Binnington came in and became part of the remedy. And we have friends that have goaltending issues. How do you tell people and explain to people, and maybe even your owner, how important goaltending is on a daily basis?
Well, as one of my favorite stories, I won't take up too much more of your time, but I was interviewing Pat Burns for a coaching job back in Dallas. And I brought the owner in to meet him. And I told him that at this time, I think it's time that we give Marty Turco this job, and he's earned it. He's a great young goalie. Eddie's had a great run. And Pat said, geez, that Brodeur is pretty good. And I said, okay, well, thanks. And so the owner comes in, I tell him the story, and Pat says, well, what I told Doug, and he added, he said, goaltending is 80% of the game. And I'm like, uh-oh. And he goes, unless you don't have it, then it's 100. So he said, that Turco better be good. And to Marty's credit, he was a hell of a goalie. But to answer your question, goaltending is a huge part of our game. And it always has been and always will be.
Yeah, and I've gone down this. John knows exactly where I'm going to go with this, because
why isn't he the highest paid player on the team then?
Well, everybody, we all know this is not Doug Armstrong's opinion here.
Yeah,
it's everybody's opinion that goaltending makes the difference in most situations, and yet goaltenders rarely are drafted number one, almost never are the highest paid. That's always been a puzzlement to me.
I would say it's probably because they come from so many different areas in the draft, and very few goalies' star shines that bright for an extended period of time. So you might have, if you look at there's 20 star players in the league, there might be 3 star goalies in the league. Now, if you have one and you know that, Marty Brodeur, Patrick Waugh, Eddie Belfour, Eddie left sure. Dallas and continued to play good. But if you make a mistake and you overpay a guy $10 million and all of a sudden he can't do it, then that's a long time to wait to buy him out or to get through that. So I would say that the best player in the NHL and the worst skater in the NHL, the variance is, we'll say, from 1 to 10. The best goalie and the worst goalie in the variance is probably from 1 to 5. Meaning there's not, but that one is really good. And I just look at Tampa Bay. They have the best goalie on the planet right now. And that's not tampering. He's the difference maker. But, and you see Carey Price when he's doing that too. But there's a lot of guys that they're at that next tier that can't sustain that.
Well, and sustaining it, I think, is the real key. As you can have guys that can have a great year, and yet, and it's their contract year, and you're inclined to say, well, you know, the guys, he had a great season. Got to pay him the money.
How many 18-year-old goaltending phenoms burn out before they even play well in the NHL?
Well,
how many?
Most of them on their second or third team. You know, it's amazing how many guys get good on their second or third team. And Les Jackson, who I worked with, who I got a ton of respect for, he said the NHL fails as many players as players fail the NHL. And I think that's not just with goaltending, but putting younger players in positions to fail, not succeed by in the league early is something that we try and learn from.
Yeah. Not deliberately. I mean, you're not trying to fail deliberately. It's just part of the equation, I guess. Doug, always good to see you. It's great to hear from you. And thank you very much for taking a few minutes from us. Continued success on the road. Good luck with Pittsburgh and the rest of the way. And we'll look forward to having you on again.
I know there's that secret Olympic file in Doug's office that we have to smuggle out of there one day to figure out what that roster was going to look like. That's the one.
Only 70% of it.
We got, well, I think Armstrong had 100%, but he had to run the other 30% through the other guys. That's the,
or that's already team, in the, so. That's already in this incinerator. That will, no one will ever know.
Sure. There's no sense. Hey, guys. The secret files of Doug Armstrong. I don't think so, man. I don't think so.
Guys, thanks. I just want to thank you for having me on. I always enjoy talking to you guys. It's always a lot of fun. Thank you.
Thanks, Doug. And we're back. McCown and Shannon, our thanks to Doug Armstrong. Always enjoyable.
So we assume that if there is an Olympic team in 2026 to go to the Winter Games in Italy, would you suggest that Doug Armstrong's the manager then too? I guess, huh?
Well, why? Because he didn't get the opportunity this time?
Yeah. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out there.
Well, I haven't thought about it for even one second, so I'm not going to make an offer an opinion right off the top of my head. But mm-hmm. I don't know what the criteria is for choosing a general manager. What if Armstrong is no longer the general manager? Well, then he probably wouldn't be the general manager. What if someone else has achieved some notoriety?
Exactly.
So I guess the answer is, I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
I look it, and this is not, in no way am I trying to diminish the significance of the general manager's role with Team Canada, but that's the easiest job in the world.
You think, huh?
Pretty much.
How many times in our interview with Doug did he talk not about the top guys? It's the decisions of making the 10th, 11th, 12th forward. And that's where the angst would be. That's where the angst and the decisions would come tougher.
Well, I did an interview.
You know, the sixth, seventh, eighth defense.
I did an interview earlier today and told the host exactly how difficult it is to do this program. And he bought it.
And you told him it was hard?
Yeah, I told him, it's like incredibly difficult. You know, all you're seeing is the iceberg above the waterline, and there's 90% below the waterline, and how hard we work to put all the pieces together.
You sold that again?
Yeah, I did. And
and you say it with pride? You say it with pride?
I said it with a slight smirk, but he didn't know me well enough to know that it was a smirk.
Oh.
And so, but don't sell me on how tough it is. And I love Doug Armstrong. You know that.
By the way, I
have a great deal of respect for him. But that ain't a hard job. That's pretty much it. Okay. Yes, yes, yes.
You and I might be the tip of the iceberg. The guy behind the scenes on this show, Hugh McLarty, is below, and he's doing all the heavy lifting.
Oh, he does. Okay. He does next to nothing.
He's doing all the heavy lifting.
Less than what we do.
Well, then he's got to do more.
The truth of the matter is, it's not that big. It's an honor to have the job. It is not a task. You're selecting the best of the best. Yeah. And look at, when you get down to the 20th, 21st, 25th guy on the roster, I don't even know how big the rosters are. What are they, 26, something like that?
25, 26, yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. When you get down to 25 and 26, whatever. Who cares?
That's not the way our country works when it
comes
to hockey.
The top 10 or 15 are going to make the difference one way or the other.
Sure,
the rest of them, they're just along for the ride.
But you know as well as I do, when it comes to hockey in this country, the discussion points aren't about Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner. It's
I'm not going to sit here
on the fourth line.
I'm not going to justify that. I'm not. I have no sympathy for the lame brain hockey pucks, of which you are one, by the way.
Thank you.
Who would waste valuable time contemplating the relative merits of player A versus player B to be the number eight defenseman on Team Canada?
Who's the third goalie?
Does he even take a shot in practice? He ain't playing in the game.
In practice, he would take a shot.
When's the last time the number three goaltender played a game for Team Canada in any tournament? Go ahead.
Well, 2002. That's a good question. I'd have to.
Yeah, it is a good question.
I'd have to open my crack research.
The point is, it's not obvious because it almost never happens. Yeah. So the relevance of that number three goaltender is zero. The number eight or number nine defenseman, how often does he get on the ice?
Well, we pretty much zero. Doug talked about PK, right?
Yeah, talked about PK Subban, barely played.
Yeah.
Barely played. I mean, I'm happy that he was a cheerleader, and that doesn't surprise me at all.
And he got a gold medal.
Good for him. Yeah. But the debate over whether he should have been on the team.
And I'll tell you what, there was a ton of debate. The Subban deserve to be there? Who should be there? What about, you know, Jay Bouwmeester?
Well, but that's the stupidity of hockey fans.
That's the passion of the sport in our country, Robert.
The problem with hockey is they need to find a more intelligent level of fan. There are too many stupid people that like the game.
Well,
we have to stop listening to them more often.
Here's the deal then. Tomorrow, let's talk basketball. How's that? Yeah, we're going to talk basketball
tomorrow. We were going to talk about it a bit today during the break, but we got carried away. Who's coming on? Can you tell me? Have you talked to the producer?
It's COVID-laden Doug Smith and Michael Grange.
Well, Smitty got COVID?
Yep.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, so he can't even go to it.
Can't catch it over Zoom, can you?
You never know. It's pretty tough.
All right, we got to go because we're late. The serious guys will be phoning us.
They don't even listen, so don't worry about it.
They have no idea what's on. They got 200 channels. They can't all be listening to us. We'll see you tomorrow. Goodbye, everybody.